Welcome to the Unsweetened SIO podcast. My name is Siobhan Harris. I am a certified integrative nutrition health coach and the founder of unsweetenedsio.com. I gave up all sugar and all flour on January 13th, 2018, and am finally free of my addiction. My mission is to help other sugar addicts find their path to freedom and live the sweet life without sugar.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 158 of Unsweetened SIO, the podcast. Really excited to have Sue Brown today with us. Sue lost 52 pounds in 52 weeks when she was 52 by going simply sugar-free, which is her code phrase for unraveling her lifelong sugar addiction. Sue has always known that her weight problem was in her head, not her body, that sugar delivered great highs and moments of intense clarity and inspiration and comfort. As a child at breakfast, she heaped sugar on frosted flakes and washed it all down with Tang. After all, if it was good enough for astronauts, it must be good enough for her. At lunch, she shunned cold cuts for PB&J on Wonder Bread. Dinner was usually mac and cheese or spaghetti. That's 100% carb day, a recipe for an epic fail. But that's what she wanted, what she craved. Her hardworking but poor single mother was doing the best she could, unwittingly caught in the trap between a sugar-craving child and a food industry that was and still is happy to accommodate those cravings in the name of profit. Along the way, she went from comforting herself with sugar to using it like a drug, unable to stop. It helped her cope with what she would come to know and love as her highly sensitive personality, a tendency towards introversion, and a relentless creative drive. For 15 years now, she has been in remission from sugar addiction and works tirelessly to help others improve their lives one step at a time. Sue is a health coach and the author of Simply Sugar Free, Six Simple Steps to Conquer Sugar Addiction. So happy to have you here today with us, Sue. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So excited for you to kind of share your story. And I've been reading your book. It's amazing. I highly recommend it to everybody. We'll make sure we link that in the episode notes, how to order that through Amazon. But let's get started. You kind of alluded in the intro to, you know, having sugar on your frosted flakes and washing it all down with Tang. So tell us a little bit about your own journey. And, you know, it sounds like this started for you in pretty early childhood, like it does for a lot of us.
Yeah, I think I have the classic sugar addiction story when you wind it back as far as you can. And I think I didn't recognize it as an addiction. Well, I didn't even know it was an addiction, but it didn't blow up in my face until I was in high school. And like many of us, we start at a young age preferring things that are sweet because our brains are wired in a particular way that we prefer sweets. But I found that I didn't use sugar as a coping mechanism until I was in high school. And what happened for me is that it was tied in with some social anxiety. Now, unlike a bunch of addicts, I had a magnificent childhood. Now, granted, it was a single mom in a trailer park and we were poor, but we had a wonderful existence in this trailer park because she loved me more than anything in the world. And I didn't know there was a different world out there because everybody in the trailer park was kind of like us. So I don't have childhood trauma, but I did find as I was growing up that often I didn't fit in, which again is something many of us identify with. And when I first started actually medicating myself, it was with peanut butter cups, and it was at a summer camp. So I grew up in Michigan, in rural Michigan, and was lucky enough to have a scholarship to Interlochen, which is a very well-known music camp in the Midwest in Traverse City. And when you go to Interlaken, everybody wears a uniform. That's part of the gig there. And at the time, and I think it's still true, everybody wears navy blue corduroy knickers and light blue poplin shirts. And it's meant to sort of hide and mask social class. And most of the kids who are there are talented in some way in the arts. So partly I fit in, and partly I didn't, because a lot of the kids were very well to do. And I found that I had to relieve anxiety the best way was finding the vending machine that had the peanut butter cups. And I put on about 25 pounds the first summer I went to Interlaken, eating peanut butter cups for social anxiety. And this sort of then morphed into a yo-yoing weight pattern that many of us have. And because sugar addiction is progressive, and as we age, it gets a little more difficult over time to manage the weight. You know, in my 20s and 30s, I could exercise, I could restrict, I could do all kinds of things. I had children in my late 30s. That really makes it complicated, because now you don't have the time to exercise, and it's much harder to stay away from bad foods, because it's what the kids want, right? So my 30s, 40s became very difficult. And it took me to this moment when I was 52. Now, I had tried Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, hypnosis, group therapy, a registered diet. I had tried it all. And I could be successful for short periods of time. But then when left to my own devices, nothing had really gotten me to the point of understanding that I was an addict. I was like, hey, I'm kind of smart, and I kind of know what to do, and I'm kind of motivated. So why the heck can I not figure this out? And so I was 52, and at a particularly low time, right? So my weight was up. I had a 38-year IT career. And that had its ups and downs, because I'm kind of, you know, right-brained, kind of, you know, the colorful part of the world, not the linear off on black, white. And so not every supervisor who got me assigned to them thought I was the best thing that happened to them, because some of them wanted the IT programmers, and I was over here wanting to design websites and do social media. So it was at a bad time in my career. My kids were at a difficult age, and I just felt kind of burned out. But I happened to go to a retirement party by this gentleman who had been kind of a mentor of mine. And I hadn't even planned to go. I was like, yeah, no, I don't need to go. But somebody stopped by and said, come on, let's go to Larry's retirement party. And I did. And that retirement party changed my life. And I think most of us have some kind of a light bulb moment where we go, aha. So I'm in the reception line and I'm shaking his hand. And he took the time to just tell me how much I had meant to him in a professional way, because we had been on a big re-engineering project together. You know, we were going to save our company from failure by doing better computer systems. And in that moment, when he reminded me of the value that I had, that I wasn't feeling in my current chain of command, I just said, this is it. I've had it. I am going to conquer this. So it's December 14th, 2006, and I'm 52. And notice it's right before Christmas. What a bad time to decide you're going to conquer sugar addiction. But I just said, you know, it's a little quiet at work. I'm going to take some time off over the holidays. I will figure this out. And for me, it took reading one particular book. And many of us also have a book that changed our lives. And again, mine goes a little far back, because I'm 67 now. It's been 15 years since that day. And the book I read was Sweet Poison by David Gillespie. And he's an Australian. And he was the first person that told the story about the differences between fructose and glucose and how they impact our brain and our body. And in that telling of that difference between the two molecules. It just gets so far into the chemistry. But that's where I found my freedom, was understanding that. And so I just, for me, I tackled it one meal at a time. And it took 6-7 weeks to kind of get to a place where I felt like I had, food wasn't talking to me anymore. You know, I was the kind of food addict that food talked to me. It came out of the trash can after putting it in. It came out of the freezer. We all know where chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream came from sugar addicts, because we'll eat it frozen. And so it was the first time that food didn't talk to me, I think, since I was in high school. And I just kept working, again, mostly by myself, because back in the day, there weren't that many people who were talking about sugar as an addictive substance. And I pretty much had to find my own way, because I couldn't find other people to help me. And I tried. I went to a registered dietitian, a very famous, well-known person, but she wasn't really talking addiction at the time, and I really wasn't identifying as an addict. So that, in my mind, was an epic fail. I went to a retreat back in that time frame from a very famous woman who kind of founded sugar addiction. But boy, I got there and she looked so sick, like morbidly obese. And this is not about weight. This is about brain for me, but it's hard to find a mentor who's morbidly obese. And then I tried another person who's quite famous and still is, but she was so dogmatic. She looked at my book and she said, "Oh no, I can't promote this because you have drug foods in here." And from my point of view, she had thrown out the baby with the bathwater, because she just believes differently than I do. And I think there's room for everybody, because there are many paths to the top of the mountain and you need to have room for everybody. So I had tried, but I found myself kind of out there on my own at that time. But I found what worked for me, and that it brought me peace and has continued to work for me. I've maintained the weight loss, which again is not the emphasis here, but it is a piece of data that I use to know that, yep, this is still working for me.
Yeah, that's incredible, your story. And I'm sure people relate to so many different parts of it. And yeah, especially at that time, you know, I too gave up sugar and flour on my own because I didn't find the exact program that really like called to me. But, and that was just 5 years ago, you know, you're talking 15 years ago. I do feel like now though, I tell people all the time, it's a great time to be a sugar addict if you're looking for help, because there's so many more resources out there. So many more of us that are sharing our stories, coaching, helping other people, just a lot more awareness about the, you know, addiction that, you know, with sugar, and a lot more people talking about it. So I do feel like, you know, if you can, I always say that you can do it on your own. I do think it's easier when you have a community and people that can support you. But I love that for both of us, we were still able to do it on our own. And with that, both of us, I think, had that intuition of like needing it to do it our way in order for it to be long-term and sustainable, you know, because even in the beginning, I'd listen to other people that were like, well, they gave up grains too, so I need to give up all grains, or they gave up nuts or whatever it was. But as soon as I started trying to eliminate more things, I found myself getting really triggered. So there's, like you said, we're all so different. We also are both Integrative Institute of IIN health coaches. So I know a big part of that is like the bio individuality. What works for one person doesn't work for everybody. And I totally believe that about, you know, our recovery too. not one addict is like another, and what works for one might not work for another. So like you said, there's different paths to the top of the mountain. And I really love that. And like you said, you know, you worked with some really well-known people that still didn't click. So that is something you just kind of want to pause and mention to people listening, because I do hear this a lot. Well, I've tried this and I was a part of this group, but I didn't want to weigh and measure. I didn't want to do that. Like, that's okay. Find what works for you. Some people that works really well, but I just want to encourage people that are listening that maybe tried a group or a program that didn't work and they just felt like, oh, it's me. It's not. It's finding what works for you. There are so many different ways to do it, and no one way is correct. It's the way that really works for you. And the way you know that is if it's sustainable. I mean, look at you now, 15 years later, like you're saying, you're still doing this. And yeah, you were able to maintain the weight loss. I agree, that's not the end all be all. Although for me, I always say this, weight loss was a huge motivator because I was, you know, at probably my heaviest at the time that I started. But now it's just, again, like you said, kind of, it's just data to have, and it's been a side benefit to all the other things that have come from me being free of my addiction. But it is still really, you know, something that I'm really grateful for every day that I can go. And like right now, it's starting to get to be the fall, you know, colder temperatures. And I know that the jeans that I put away for the summer are still going to fit me, when before that was like, oh gosh, what's going to fit? What's not going to fit? My closet had every size. It could have been like a clothing store. It had every size of clothing. So I do think that, like you said, that the data of it just being, okay, this is still working for me, you know, even if not everyone does it this exact way, this is what's working for me. So thank you for, you know, saying that and sharing that. And I am curious, you know, now that it's been 15 years later, kind of talk to us about how maybe it has evolved a little bit, you know, your eating and just even more talk about the benefits that you have found, or even maybe some of the challenges in this 15 years. Because I think a lot of us sometimes go into thinking, oh, if I can solve this, everything's going to be smooth and perfect. Life will just be great. But we know that that's not the case. We're still going to have these challenges. So I'm just curious now to kind of hear more about what these past 15 years, you know, have been like for you.
Sure. You know, recently I attended Bitten Janssen, who is one of our, you know, sheroes, one of our heroes in this world. An intensive in Bristol, England. And I forget where I was going with this, but anyway, I'd been wanting to go for a while. And what I valued about that, because I continue to learn all the time, right? I mean, I recovered so long ago that some of the rules have changed and some of the science has changed. So one of the things that I do is I try to stay current without jeopardizing my own success, right? So when you talk to some of the people, you know, there's a lot of debate between moderation and abstinence. And I think each person owes it to themselves to find what works for them. Because any time that I tried to be too strict, like you mentioned, if I have friends who go on Whole30, I fail, because Whole30 removes some things that don't need to be removed for me. And I think it can be a challenge, because a lot of coaches and programs might start with abstinence. And for some people, maybe that's necessary because they can't unravel for themselves what it is they can eat and what it is they can't eat. But I think I need to be brave enough to stand up and say, I have found my recovery and it may look a little different than yours. And that bravery has been important to me. because in particular, I really can't have fructose, which is the very sweet part component of sugar. And in its natural state, it's fruit sugar. That's where its name comes from, fructose, fruit sugar. And, you know, back in the, you know, caveman days, we were wired to want fructose, especially as winter approached, because fructose is metabolized in your liver and saved as fat, and everyone needed it for the winter. But as they processed fructose, it becomes really sweet. And when it's put into foods in the form of, for example, high fructose corn syrup, or even dried fruit, which is a processed kind of fruit where it's more sugar than fruit, for my brain, that is what talks to me. Grains don't talk to me. And that's not true for a majority of people, I might say. And I had to kind of unravel that myself, although occasionally a grain will talk to me. You know, kids, goldfish crackers can talk to me. So if you get a grain with fat and salt that's highly palatable, once in a while, one of those will talk to me. But for me, I had to find that really I must be abstinent from anything intensely sweet. And I just need to keep an eye on some of those other things. But gosh, I hear people talking about how they can't have a loaf of bread in the house. That's true for them, but it's not true for me. I can have a loaf of bread for a month. It'll go bad before I will eat it. So, you know, I think everybody just has to kind of unravel that. Because when you do that for yourself, when you know what you can't eat, then it starts to open up the whole world of what you can eat. And that ties into my success over 15 years. So, you know, for 5 or 10 years, I just kind of motored on. I kept being a mom. I kept being an IT person. I went back to school at the Institute for Integrative Nutrition after I had lost the weight, just because I wanted to have a more well-rounded background in nutrition. And I wanted to be able to be a health coach. And I was looking ahead to what would I do when I retired. And I'm really glad I did that, because I ended up retiring and I am a health coach. So I'm glad that I gave myself kind of a running head start on that. But with IIN, it's a very broad background. It was very useful. I met some wonderful people, Deepak Chopra, Mark Hyman, you know, a lot of really good people. But there really wasn't sugar addiction as a part of their curriculum, you know? So I enjoyed going to IIN, and that was like, you know, 10 years into my recovery, I was at IIN. I actually ended up pitching a course to them on sugar addiction. So I'm currently in one of their modules talking about sugar addiction. So I've tried to, you know, influence by doing what I can. So they have at least their current graduates get a little information about that.
Okay, I got to pause there because that makes me so happy. I did not know that. So that makes me so happy, because my story is a little different. I went to IIN trying to help myself. I thought, you know, there has to be some kind of, you know, diet out there that's going to help me. And I tried it all. You know, when we learned the raw food, I went raw food. When it was vegan, I was vegan, carnivore, whatever. I tried it all. And like you said, though, there was no, and I went in 2017, so we were probably similar timing, and there was nothing about sugar addiction. There was stuff about emotional eating and binge eating disorder. And I had already sought treatment for binge eating disorder. But once I heard that again, I kind of doubled down on this binge eating disorder. I reached out because I really liked the speaker to her directly, started working with her on one-on-one. And of course, moderation is, you know, what was told for binge eating disorder. So, you know, I went kind of down that path again, away from, unfortunately for me, I really needed to abstain. But I reached out to IIN afterwards and was just like, you know, once I kind of did figure out my sugar addiction and just as a kind of just, hey, to the alumni team, as a graduate and now, you know, recovering sugar addict, this is something that really needs to be part of the curriculum. Like, why is it not? And they said, well, because it's not medically recognized. So I was really disappointed in that. But I am so glad to hear that you, you know, took it up a notch and said, well, let me teach a module about it. So now, from what I'm understanding, that is a part of their curriculum. And that makes me so happy. Well done, Sue. I mean, that alone, you should be so proud of how many people you're going to reach just like that. Cause there's so many health coaches that go through this program and, you know, probably we're trying to help sugar addicts without knowing that that's really what's going on. So it's just that another piece of knowledge for them to have, because as we know, moderation isn't going to help an addict. So just to be aware of that. Thank you so much. Sorry to interrupt, but I am just like in amazement that you did that.
You know, so one of the things at 67, you try to figure out what is your role in all of this ecosystem, you know, and mine's about sharing information. So anytime I can, like, you know, share information, I'm about doing that, because I'm not building a career. I'm not even really building a practice. I'm just more about connecting, but, you know, more about that in a minute. So when I continue on about some of the challenges of 15 years in recovery, so I have just, I call it hibernation, but I've just had 4 years from hell, and I'm very open about that. My husband, 4 years ago, was diagnosed out of the blue with a very rare and basically fatal blood cancer. So 4 years ago, he's 61, perfectly healthy, on no medication. He wakes up one day and he says, you know, I'm feeling a little bit tired. I think I ought to go to the doctor. And so he does. And the doctor does the usual annual physical and calls back that afternoon. And he says, I don't know where the closest emergency room is, but I want you there now. He said, your blood counts are so bad, you really can't be out of a sterile setting. And we like went, what? And so we, you know, I was on a business call at the time, and I'm like, I'm sorry, boss, gotta go. And we went to the local hospital, and Philly has lots of good hospitals, but we went to the suburban one closest to us, and they watched him for a week. They couldn't figure it out. They said, yeah, it's a blood thing, but it looks like it's two blood things, and nobody gets two blood things at once. So here's an ambulance, and you're going to Penn, which is Philly's one of their premier hospitals. So we go to Penn. And they spend like a week and they say, oh yeah, it's true. You have two blood cancers at once, which is like having breast cancer and four broken legs. You know, it's just, it just doesn't happen. And they eventually figured out that they were going to treat the one that was on the verge of killing him. And that was a 2-year journey. So that was stressful. I'm working full time. The pandemic breaks out. Our two kids had empty nested because they were mid-20s, and they both came home to help manage him while I worked. I had the health insurance. He was $2 million before it was over with. So that was stressful. And I'm so grateful that I understood about the addictive piece, so I knew what to eat and what not to eat. And the self-care piece, because once you've got the food figured out for yourself, it's all about self-care. It's like, okay, he's going to need chemo 3 times this week. That means trips into the city. It's the pandemic. I'm going to have to sit in a parking garage for 3 hours. How do I manage that? And I just was very intentional about always trying to manage the schedule, knowing what he needed and what I needed, putting him first. But like when they would say, what time do you want to come for chemo? We would go after my morning walk, because that would set me up for success without jeopardizing his health. So I think if I hadn't been strong in my food recovery and in my self-care, It was a lot. We had to relocate. We moved from Philadelphia to Tampa, Florida for 4 months. My son had to donate stem cells. Originally, it looked really good. And then the cancer came back and he passed. It was a total of 2 years. And then now it's been 2 years since that. And that hasn't been a picnic either. So he passed. I decided to retire because I turned 66. I had Medicare. And I didn't really realize the impact of retiring on my social life because I never thought I was best friends with the people at work. But when you lose your husband and your friends at work, and then the kids both said, hey, we're done living at home. The pandemic's getting a little bit better. So, you know, one heads to Florida for a fresh start and the other one just heads out of the house and into Center City, Philadelphia. So I found the last 2 years have not been a walk in the park either. I lost my best friend of 33 years, my job of 38 years by my choice, the kids, my identity as an IT person. So it's still not exactly been easy. And that was why I really ended up at the intensive in Bristol with Bitten, even though I'm 15 years recovered. Because I knew I was depressed and lonely and bored and a lot of things I had never been before in my life. And I was just clawing to find my way out of a black hole that I'd never been in before. And I had a wonderful childhood. I didn't have trauma. And I'd never faced so many dark things all at once. And I'm just so grateful that I went to that intensive. There were 22 of us, and we were at an organic farmhouse outside of Bristol. And we were just learning about food addiction. And it was this wonderful mix of professionals and people still struggling. And what I liked about that mixture, because I'm a little bit of both, right? I'm a recovered sugar addict, but also kind of sort of once in a while a health coach. And at the end of that week, I was so buoyed up by both kinds of people, and especially the people who were still struggling, because what they saw in me was hope. And that's what even here on the podcast, you know, I hope I give people hope because it is 15 years and the first 10 years were kind of easygoing, and then it got hard with my husband's cancer, the pandemic, and all of that. But for me, I have found, and we can talk a little bit about the six-step process, but for me, it's a little bit like you've got the food on the one hand, and then you've got behaviors on the other hand. And I kind of look at it like tying your shoes. You know, you need the grommets and your laces kind of go back and forth, and you can tighten it and you can loosen it. So sometimes, you know, you might want to tighten your shoes really tight because you need all the help and support you can get. And then there are other times that you're kind of coasted and you kind of leave them a little loose, and you might even treat them like slip-ons, you know, and never untie your shoes. So for me, during the 4 years that were the most stressful, what worked for me was having the food solid and then occasionally letting a little extra volume come in. You know, I knew not to stray from my abstinent foods. Don't let in sugar ever, no way, no how. But you might want a few extra blueberries one day or a couple of other things that are okay for you, because the stress is nearly unmanageable. So I think that's part of my success, was just staying true to what I needed to be abstinent from and occasionally having a little more volume just because I had to.
Yeah, and being able to do that occasionally without that becoming, you know, a behavioral problem like happens a lot. I love that you broke that down to the, you know, with the behavior part and just how important the self-care part is. Yes, finding that food plan that works for you. But then the self-care is such a bigger part of the journey. And to hear, you know, again, you going through what and what you're still going through. I mean, you're still in it, right? Like, I'm sure you're feeling like you're getting there, but you're still really in it. And to even like have that again, like to think, okay, to get my husband through this, I need to make sure I get my walk in first. Just making those plans, setting you up for as successful as you can be and really upping that self-care to balance out, you know, I mean, that to me is just so incredible. And I don't know if someone that had less recovery would have been able to do that. Right. So that is really, I think, going to be really inspiring to a lot of people that are listening and just, you know, reminding us that we all go through these really hard things, but we can still do it in a way that's putting our recovery first and being respectful of it. And I'm so impressed by you with how you're able to kind of see, yep, these foods are definitely off, but if I have a few more blueberries, that's not going to throw me over the edge. And that just shows me how much experimentation you've done and how well you really know your body and what works for you and what doesn't work for you. So I think that's amazing. And I'm sure you have to be proud, like thinking if you had gone through this, say, before you were 52, imagine how different it would look. Like, it's hard now. But had you also been, you know, struggling with your addiction and not, I mean, it would have just been so much worse, I'm sure. So I'm really grateful for your recovery, just kind of probably being, you know, pretty big anchor for you right now, just going forward. So, and I hope a lot of people listening that to that can hear that message and of hope and that you're still going, you know. And I would love for you to talk a little more. You've kind of alluded to the, you know, your six simple steps to conquer sugar addiction. If you'd want to share, you know, some of those and that would be great.
Sure. So, you know, everything is a little controversial and open for interpretation, but my first step is having breakfast. And I know, you know, so I wrote my book 8 years ago, and now there's keto and carnivore and intermittent fasting and all those things. I don't know how strongly I feel about breakfast today, but when I was doing my own healing, one of the books I read was, you know, Potatoes Not Prozac, and one of the first books about sugar addiction. And, you know, she was 20 grams of protein within an hour of your feet hitting the floor. That works for me, so I'm sticking with that for now. I don't know, intermittent fasting works for some people. Maybe I would monkey with that in the future. Like, I am going to go to a keto conference in January for the first time. So I don't know, but for me. And I'm also part of a research study called the National Weight Control Registry, and I have been for 15 years. And that's a National Institutes of Health thing that is following people who have lost weight and kept it off. Because weight is a huge problem in America, and they're trying to figure out what makes you successful, not just losing weight, but keeping it off. And when you look at their research, breakfast is an anchor of that success. So for right now, I'm sticking with breakfast, 20 grams of protein within an hour. My second step, and that's over on the food side. And then on a behavior side, I call it find your frequency. But really, I mean journaling. I mean writing down what you eat and how you feel so that you can begin to establish the pattern of what works for you and what doesn't. Before you cut the sugar out, learn for yourself and just what you eat, how you feel 20 minutes later, 2 hours later, and what do you learn? My third step is back over on the food side, and I just call it add before you subtract. Most people aren't eating enough food. So when I work with women primarily, they need to eat more, not less. They're eating the wrong food, but they're not eating enough of the good food. So I try to pack in some better food. And then I go back over to the behavior side, and I just call it get up and go. And that's the exercise side. For me, I started walking an hour a day 15 years ago. And I think I've only missed 5 or 6 days when it was just impossible. And that's one of the reasons I've moved recently, right? I was in Philadelphia. It gets cold, it gets icy, it's nasty in the winter. I have a kid in Ocean City, New Jersey in the summer where it's warm. And now I have a kid in Florida where it's also warm, but in the winter. And I'm here so I can walk every day on the beach. So whatever it is, it's what works for you. I don't like to run. I don't like to do weights, although I think I should, but find out what works for you and do it. Then I go back over to the food side in step 5, and that's slash the sugar. So on the food side, you've been eating breakfast, you've been eating more, and now you're going to take out the sugar. Because by that point, I think people can be successful. And then once they've taken out the sugar, they go back over to the behavior side, and it's love yourself silly. So that's the self-care piece. And we all know that once you've got the food figured out, it really is. It's the behavior stuff, right? It's how do you keep yourself from doing bad things, going to Dunkin' Donuts? How do you fix those behaviors? So those are the steps that I usually work through. And I think they kind of build on one another. And I also like that you can later go through with a person, if you're coaching, you can go back and look at each of them and say, well, is this one strong or is this one strong, and find out where they're weak. Now, what I'm personally looking at moving forward is now about the combination of addiction. It's more like the marriage of addiction and metabolic health. So Bitten and a lot of the keto people are now looking at how do you marry the two of those? Because now you've got two different ways of looking at the world. You know, addiction is largely in the brain, and the metabolic health is what's happening in your liver and all of those other places with your insulin and your fat storage. So, you know, I think if I were to write another book, or where my next area of interest lies, it's in that, because as I work with other people, and again, the people who are attracted to me are basically women in my age group, because they go, oh, wow, I want what you have. And some people aren't addicts and they have weight and health problems. And I would like to be more well-versed on the metabolic side for their benefit.
I love that. And I love, yeah, being able to, like, just being able to help more people that way. Cause like you kind of are saying all along, not everyone needs to abstain from everything, you know, but for me, I know I need to abstain from all sugar and all flour. It's just, that's what works for me, but that's not what works for everybody. And there's still a lot of people out there that need help with their, you know, their weight and just even overall health, but maybe they don't need to be completely, you know, abstinent forever. So I love that you're just kind of getting more knowledge, like you said, on how to marry those two things together and then be able to help address more issues. I really think that's like the future too of all of this, of how we're going to just help more and more people. We're just getting more and more information of part of this big puzzle all coming together. And I love your 6 steps. Thank you for sharing them with us and just addressing the food part of it and the behavior part of it. To me, really that 6th step, you know, loving yourself silly. I like that. Or I call it like, you know, extreme self-care. You know, it's not just like, yeah, you know, it's extreme self-care. And I think, Sue, we are related somewhere because I also grew up in Philadelphia. We went to IIN. I also need to take an hour long walk every day. If it's on the beach, that's just a bonus. So I am curious though, what else maybe you could share just in, you know, the remaining time that we have, because I think that part of loving yourself silly is so critical. So any other things that maybe you can share in that area that have worked for you, just as like kind of this tool and resource for people listening? Because I do think this is so, so critical to long-term success, and especially with what you are going through right now. I'm also going through some challenging times, and it's like, this is the piece that has to, the food has to be strong, but this self-care piece too, I think needs to be strong as well. So what are some other things that work for you?
So lately, breathing is one of my favorite techniques. And I really, you know, simple, That's my tagline to everything, you know, is I want to keep it simple because you can get lost in all of the information. But even, you know, my Apple Watch, you know, it has a breathing thing that every morning for 1 minute, it makes a noise and that tells me how long to breathe out and how long to breathe in. And just remembering to breathe through your nose is huge because that's what triggers, you know, the calming effect of the breathing. I get a lot of pedicures, and it's not necessarily because I want my feet to look good, but I want people to rub my feet. And part of that is being a widow. I don't have anybody touching me, right? I need some oxytocin. So I recognize that. And one of my cures is to get a pedicure, and don't think that I'm being frivolous. I have a cat, and I now intentionally, when I pet my cat, we have a little conversation about oxytocin, just so that I'm more conscious about this is good for both of us. Her name is Beamer, you know, this is good for both of us, you know, and I'm trying to raise my oxytocin with my cat. And I think I journal. I like colored markers. And if I really get lost, the first thing I'll do is draw. I'm very visually oriented, and I will draw pictures and timelines and just try to figure out the patterns in my life. Recently, I was called to do one about my circle of friends because I'm kind of lonely as a widow, and I'm trying to solve that. And I know when I was in Bristol, I stood up, we had to introduce ourselves, and I was crying. I'm a widow, and I'm lonely, and I'm bored, and I don't know where I fit in. And, you know, in that meeting, Bitten was the one who said, you know, a wolf can only find its tribe when it howls. And I was glad that I had howled in that setting. I felt a little awkward. I was the only one who stood up and cried. But, you know, what happened is that people came up to me with ideas and suggestions. So now I'm volunteering. And that's a real self-care-ish kind of thing to do. And like you had mentioned, you know, sugar addiction is not in the DSM-5 and all those technical things. And through the Food Addiction Institute, there's a team that's putting together a website, trying to bring together professionals, trying to get it recognized. So I'm helping that team build a website. And I'm also helping a group that's trying to bring more knowledge to children and to schools. So, you know, that is bringing me purpose that I didn't have before I sat in that room in May. So I think what I would mostly tell people is just don't ever get up and give up. And if one thing doesn't work for you, keep going. And if one person doesn't resonate with you, find somebody else and listen to podcasts. You know, when I walk for an hour a day, some days I want to listen to music, some days I want to listen to a book, and other days I listen to podcasts. I listen to your podcast. I listen to Food Junkies. You know, it's free. Come on, you know, there's no reason not to. So I think my message today is just that of hope and don't give up, because that's why I'm here 15 years later, feeling like a million bucks.
I love that so much. Thank you. And I am so jealous too, because I really wanted to be in Bristol with all you amazing people. And I love that you got to go and speak up and how and get that support, because you have so many talents, you know, really, and skills that is really going to help this movement. So you are a very valuable member of this community, which I'm very grateful for, you know, just even being able to build that website to have that made. For me, I want to talk offline later about what you're doing with the schools, because that to me is very, very important, as I have like a 7 and 9 year old and navigating all that right now. So that is so true. Just to sometimes that's a really huge part of self-care, is get involved and give your time. I mean, it's so rewarding and fulfilling, especially when you're able to use these skill sets that you have that a lot of people do not have. You know, Sue also mentioned that she could help me write my book, because she helped with the course at IIN about writing a book. And that's something that I've really struggled with. So again, you have all of these talents. So I am very grateful for you and what you're doing for this community, because really, it's really incredible. So thank you. And is there anything else, you know, just as we're wrapping up here, you have a great message that you said, but anything else maybe that we didn't get to, or just a way to contact you and get in touch with you if people, you know, are really listening and want to work with you?
Right. So about getting in contact with me, in some ways I've been in this 4-year hibernation. My first step coming out while I was going to Bristol, and then my second step was redoing my website. So the best way to be in touch with me is through my website. And to find me, I'm simply sugar-free everywhere. I've tried to, you know, I've got YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, you know, Amazon, all of those places. And at the moment, I'm not offering anything, but it is my goal, I think, to do some group coaching maybe in the beginning of the year, because I do believe in knowledge. I do believe in group work. I do believe in learning from one another. And I think I have things to offer. So once I have just moved to Florida, I still have boxes. If people could see, there are boxes in the background here. I think once I get settled in logistically, I may be doing some group offerings. And if anybody would want to know about that, on my website, you can enter your email address and then you would be in a database that you would get information about it.
That's perfect. Well, thank you so much. I'm really excited to just see what else you continue to do. And if I do hope you write another book, and just can't wait to see. And this might really be for you, the way to come out of this, you know, darkness and into the light, is just sharing all the gifts that you have to share. So thank you again so much for being here. It was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day, and remember, life is so much sweeter without sugar.